Shalom, Hadavarniks. Welcome to Hadavar Messianic Ministries and our School of Biblical and Jewish Studies. We're studying the Jewish life of the Messiah, and this is the 2021 edition. We're in Lesson 13, and this is Session 45. So let's go ahead and review Session 44. Now, in Session 44, Yeshua said, "I am the vine and you are the branches." And the illustration of discipleship that he used is that of grape growing, viticulture. Now, viticulture in first century Israel was different than viticulture today. In first century Israel, the vines were grown flat on the ground, and they didn't produce a lot of grapes if they were left flat on the ground. They would put down roots. You know, that's what a vine does. So they had to lift the vines up and put them on top of a rock in order to get them to bear fruit. And that's made them possible. This lifting up made it possible for the vine to bear fruit. And that's exactly what Yeshua says to us. He lifts us up. He makes it possible for us to bear fruit. And here's a picture of modern viticulture, and you see the grapevines are lifted quite high in this picture. They're lifted 3 feet high there because it's a lot easier to harvest the grapes at that height. But they don't have to be lifted quite that high. But you can see the fruit hangs down and the vines are bearing fruit. So first of all, he makes it possible for us to bear fruit by lifting us up. And then he prunes us so that we'll bear more fruit. So he'll have a tremendous harvest from each one of our lives, just like the modern grape grower does as well. Then we talked about the fact that the world hates believers. And this little cartoon, I think, summed it up for me. Before they found out you were a real, sincere Christian, they said, "Welcome. All beliefs are valid. You're our friend. We're very, very tolerant. We love diversity. Say what you like. And so you do say what you like. You proclaim the word of God, even in a very winsome and positive way. And then after they find out you're a real, sincere Christian, they say, "Go away. We can't stand your beliefs, your biblical beliefs. You're an enemy. You're a religious bigot. You think you're the only way. You're narrow-minded. Shut your mouth." And so the world hates believers. This is another example of where the world hates believers. This demonstration of some sort, I don't know exactly what it's all about, but it says, the sign says, life begins when you stand up to what? Christian fascists. So the world hates the believer. The world hated the believer in the first century when Yeshua came, and the world still hates the believer today. And I think the key is in John 15:22. "If I had not come and spoken to them, they would not have sin. But now they have no excuse for their sin." See, Yeshua has come. The gospel is being proclaimed around the world. And the world has no more excuse for sin. They know now about God's righteousness, and they know judgment is coming. So they have no excuse for sin, righteousness, and judgment. They have to face it down. And when they don't like it, they react against the believer with hatred. Now, the Jewish believer, however, gets a double whammy of this hatred, because the Christian believer is grafted into the new covenant. And so the Gentile believer receives hatred from that aspect. But we Jews are part of the Abrahamic covenant. This is an eternal, unconditional, and unilateral covenant God made with the Jewish people. And it consists of the three promises and covenants: the land promise, land covenant, national promise, Davidic covenant, and the spiritual blessing promise and the new covenant. And if Satan can pervert or destroy any one of those three legs of the Abrahamic covenant, he's won his war with God. Of course, he can't do that, but he can't get at God, so he gets at God's covenant, and he gets at the people who are grafted into God's covenant or are naturally part of God's covenant, the Jewish believers and the Gentile believers. And so that's why the Jewish believer receives a double whammy. He's not only part of the new covenant, but also we have a stake in the land promise and land covenant and the national promise and the Davidic covenant as well. That's why anti-Semitism is so strong. It is part of Satan's battle against God, his war against God. And so he, like I said, he can't attack God, so he attacks God's covenant and the people involved in God's covenants. Well, we saw that Jesus and the disciples left the upper room there on the western hill. They went down into the Kidron Valley over to the Garden of Gethsemane. And here's a picture of the actual terrain, modern terrain, down from the Western Hill into the Kidron Valley, and then north up the Kidron Valley into the Garden of Gethsemane, located in this area right here. So we took a tour of the Garden of Gethsemane last time. Here are the 2,000-year-old olive trees in the garden. Here's a close-up of one of them. Could they have witnessed Yeshua's agony in the garden? It's possible. It's possible. We also took a quick tour of the Cave of Gethsemane. This is where the olive oil factory was located. And Yeshua and his disciples might have found shelter in that cave on a number of occasions. And then as we go south in the Garden of Gethsemane, we come to the Church of All Nations, and we go into the Church of All Nations, and it marks the spot in the Garden of Gethsemane that is the traditional location of the rock on which Yeshua is said to have prayed. So there's the rock inside the Church of All Nations. That's where the agony occurred. So that's where we are. We're at Lesson 13, page 18 at the top of the page. We're looking at the agony of Gethsemane. This is one of the greatest spiritual battles that Yeshua ever fights. Yeshua undergoes a tremendous anguish described in 6 points. Now, all the Gospels must be taken into account to get a full appreciation of the agony itself. So we start on page 20 of your outline, the bottom of the page, and we start in Mark 14, verse 33. And he took with him Peter and James and John and began to be very distressed and troubled. Well, that word very distressed means surprised, stunned with astonishment. And trouble means he was under tremendous heavy pressure. So he was suddenly stunned by the astonished by the amount of spiritual pressure that suddenly came upon him like an oil press pressing down upon the olive oil, the olives. So he was very distressed and troubled under the crushing weight. Then verse 34, and he said to them, "My soul is deeply grieved to the point of death. Remain here and keep watch." Now, deeply grieved means grieved to the point of tremendous deep depression and emotional pain. And that's to the point of death, he says. This means that his sorrow, his depression, his agony was so great that there was a real danger of the total collapse of his physical frame. He was so deeply grieved to the point of death that his physical frame was on the verge of collapse. The pressure was that great, like an olive in an olive press. In Luke 22:44, and being in agony, this being in agony means he was in conflict. And the nature of the conflict is described elsewhere. In the Tanakh, it's Isaiah 49, verses 1 through 13. We'll look at that later, but right now let's look at the Brit Hadashah and Hebrews 5:7. This is a description of the agony. In the days of his flesh, he offered up both prayers and supplications with loud crying and tears to the one able to save him from death, and he was heard because of his piety. So loud crying and tears was associated with the pressure that he felt. The next aspect of the tremendous pressure is verse 44b. He was praying very fervently. That's loud cries and tears. And his sweat became like drops of blood falling down upon the ground. Well, this is a very rare condition, physical condition, known as hematidrosis, in which the pressure is so great upon the person that their blood vessels rupture and they literally sweat blood. And when this happens, you get hypersensitive to the touch. And so this would heighten the agony on the cross even more, the fact that his skin was hypersensitive to the touch. And by the way, if you're interested in hematidrosis, there is a handout in your handout section that you've downloaded from our internet page. So you can look for that handout if you're interested to read more about hematidrosis. So his sweat became like great drops of blood. Now, what is he agonizing over? What are the reasons for this terrible agony? Well, there are two main things if we compare the gospel accounts with the Brit Hadashah, with Tanakh, with the Old Testament. First, let's look at Luke 22:43. Now, an angel from heaven appeared to him, strengthening him. So this angel encourages and strengthens him by giving him a message. And so here's an illustration of the angel appearing to him in the Garden of Gethsemane. What is the message? The message is found in that Isaiah 49:1-13 passage we mentioned just a few moments ago. So let's take a look at the first four verses of Isaiah 49. Listen to me, O islands, and pay attention, you peoples from afar. The Lord called me from the womb. From the body of my mother he named me. He has made my mouth like a sharp sword. In the shadow of his hand he has concealed me, and he has also made me a select arrow. He has hidden me in his quiver. He said to me, you are my servant, Israel, in whom I will show my glory. But I said, I have toiled in vain. I have spent my strength for nothing and vanity. Yet surely the justice due to me is with the Lord, and my reward with my God. So here in verses 1-4, we have a picture of the servant of the Lord, the Messiah, and he's agonizing over the apparent failure of his mission. He offered the kingdom to Israel, but Israel has not responded. He has been faithful to his calling, faithful to the commission God gave him. And so he's agonizing over Israel's denial, Israel's rejection. Now we come to verses 5-7. And these verses describe the message that comes to the Messiah from God. Apparently, from the Luke account, this message reaches him through the angel. Again, through the Luke account. Probably the angel brings this message to him. Now the message from God to the Messiah is that Israel's rejection of his messiahship is not a failure, because it's part of the divine plan. So let's look at that section, verses 5-7. And now, says the Lord, who formed me from the womb to be his servant, to bring Jacob back to him so that Israel might be gathered to him, to bring the whole nation, every Jewish person back to him. For I am honored in the sight of the Lord, and my God is my strength. He says, it's too small a thing for that you should be my servant to raise up the tribes of Jacob and restore the preserved of Israel. It's too small a thing for you to reach out to the nation. I will also make you a light to the nations, to the Gentile nations, so that my salvation will reach to the ends of the earth. I don't have just one nation in view here, Mr. Messiah. I have the whole world in view here. Thus says the Lord, the Redeemer of Israel and its Holy One, to the despised one, to the one abhorred by the nation. There's the messianic person, rejected at his first coming. To the servant of rulers. Kings will see and arise. Princes will also bow down because of the Lord who is faithful, the Holy One of Israel who has chosen you. So in Isaiah 49, the angel states that Israel's rejection is part of God's plan. By means of Israel's rejection, the gospel will be open to the Gentiles, and the Messiah becomes the light to the Gentiles. All right, we're at the top of page 22 in your outline, and let's pick up verse 8. Thus says the Lord, in a favorable time I have answered you, and in a day of salvation I have helped you, and I will keep you and give you for a covenant of the people to restore the land, to make them inherit the desolate heritages. Saying to those who are bound, go forth, and to those who are in darkness, show yourselves. Along the roads they will feed, and their pasture will be all the bare heights. They will not hunger or thirst, nor will the scorching heat or sun strike them down. For he who has compassion on them will lead them and will guide them to the springs of water. I will make all my mountains a road, and my highways will be raised up. So the Jewish people are going to get a tremendous advantage when we're brought back to the land of our birth, to the Holy Land. God will make sure we all get there. Behold, these will come from afar, and lo, these will come from the north and from the west, and these from the land of Sinim. Sinim, by the way, is China. They'll come from from the land of Sinim, from the east. And there are Jews in China even today. Shout for joy, O heavens, and rejoice, O earth. Break forth into joyful shouting, O mountains, for the Lord has comforted his people and will have compassion on his afflicted. So this section is all about the return of the Jewish people to the land. So after a period of time that the gospel has been a light to the Gentiles and the Messiah a light to the Gentiles, then Israel will in fact return to God. He'll restore dispersed Israel. And so the Messiah is told, all that's going on is fully in accord with my plans. So now the program of Isaiah 49, we'll sum it up this way. First of all, Isaiah 49, 1 through 4, Israel rejects the Messiah. That's what we're looking at right now. And then in verses 5 through 7, the rejection opens up the messianic message to the Gentile world. And number 3, verses 8 through 13, after a time, Israel returns and is restored and regathered. Now, if you read Romans 11, in Romans 11, Rabbi Shaul, the Apostle Paul, uses this outline. This is the outline of Romans 11. By the falling of the Jews, salvation has come to the Gentiles. And so a blindness in part has befallen Israel until the fullness of the Gentiles has come in. And when the fullness of the Gentiles has come in, then all Israel shall be saved. Every living Jewish man, woman, and child who survives the tribulation will come to faith at that time. He's talking here about the remnant who survived the tribulation, all Israel. So Yeshua is agonizing over the apparent failure of his mission in relation to Israel at the present time, at the first coming. But now the message of the angel comes. Your ministry, your first coming ministry here is not a failure. It's all part of the divine plan, the first third of the divine plan. Through this means, through what you're going through now, the Gentiles will receive the gospel. And then later, in the third part of the plan, Israel, all survivors of the tribulation in the nation will be saved. All right, now that's the first thing he agonizes over, Israel's rejection. But there's another item he agonizes over, and this is page 22, the bottom of your outline, the cup. He agonizes over the cup. Now, three times he prays the same prayer. The first prayer is Mark 14:36. And he was saying, Abba, Father, all things are possible for you. Remove this cup from me. Yet not what I will, but what you will. Now, did you notice the terminology Abba? Abba is a familiar term for father. It denotes childlike intimacy and trust. In English, it could be translated daddy. 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 Childlike intimacy and trust. The Messiah is pleading with his father. The second prayer is in Matthew 26:42. He went away again a second time and prayed, My Father, if this cannot pass away unless I drink it, your will be done. Your will be done. And the third prayer, and he left them again and went away and prayed a third time, saying the same thing once more. So three times he prays, Father, Daddy, please let this cup pass from me. And then he always adds, however, only if it is your will. Don't do anything in accordance with my will. Your will be done. So he's agonizing over this cup, willing to take it if the Father so desires. Now go to the top of page 23 in your outline. And we have a question. What is the cup? What is the cup he agonizes over? Well, there's several suggestions. Number one, the cup represents his physical death. Well, there are several problems with this position. They begin with John 10:17. John 10:17 clearly predicted he was going to die. It's inevitable. There would be no atonement apart from the physical death of Messiah. So I don't think he would ask God to take this away from him and stop the work of redemption that has been planned from eternity past. All right, his physical death is part of the plan. Then there's Luke 19:10. There he clearly states that he came for the purpose of dying. For him to pray for the cup not to pass defeats the whole purpose for him being there in the first place. Then there's Philippians 2:8. Philippians 2:8 tells us that his obedience included the obedience of the cross, physical death. So if he didn't die, he'd be disobedient. Then there's Hebrews 10:5-9. Hebrews 10 states that his whole purpose was to die. So I don't believe this is a good suggestion. I don't believe that what is meant by the cup is his physical death. He's not afraid of physical death. He's totally anticipating it. All right, the second suggestion you run into would be he's afraid of dying prematurely. Well, this is not the case also. Why? Because all attempts to kill him earlier had failed because his hour had not yet come. His hour had not yet come. There's no danger of dying prematurely now either. Now, what's going to become apparent as we move from the arrest to the trial of the Messiah is that the Jewish leaders, the Romans, and Satan are not in control. Yeshua is in total control of this situation. In fact, when the Roman cohort comes to arrest him, what does he do? He's going to force that entire Roman cohort to the ground just to let him know if he's arrested. It's because he is allowing himself to be arrested. He could have left them pinned flat on the ground for 24 hours or 48 hours or however longer he wanted to. He could have just pinned them right down and walked away. But he didn't. He allowed himself to be arrested. And then there's Luke 23:46. Now Luke 23:46 says he dismissed his spirit. Life left him only when he dismissed his spirit. When the spirit leaves your body ceases to function. And so he was in charge of that. He left his body deliberately. Then there's John 10:18. Yeshua said, "No man takes my life from me. I lay it down myself." There's a confirming verse, a good parallel verse. At no point could Yeshua be killed prematurely. In essence, based upon John 10:18, no one really killed Yeshua because he allowed himself to be killed. And at the point of death, he dismisses his spirit. So this second suggestion really doesn't fit the case either. A third suggestion. He was afraid the cup representing God's wrath was permanent and there would be no resurrection. He's afraid God's wrath would consume him forever. But there's a problem with this. The resurrection was foretold. It was prophesied. It had to occur. First of all, it was foretold by the prophets. His personal resurrection was foretold by the prophets. Psalm 16:10. "For you will not abandon my soul to Sheol, nor will you allow your Holy One to undergo decay." That's picked up in Acts 13:34-35. "As for the fact that he raised him up from the dead, no longer to return to decay, he has spoken in this way, 'I will give you the holy and sure blessings of David.' Therefore," he also says in another psalm, "you will not allow your Holy One to undergo decay." So his personal resurrection is prophesied. It's got to happen. And then the principle of resurrection is prophesied in the prophets. An example is Isaiah 26:19. By the way, I love this verse. This is such a wonderful verse. "Your dead will live. Their corpses will rise. You who lie in the dust, awake! Shout for joy, for your dew is as the dew of the dawn, and the earth will give birth to the departed spirits." So there's the principle of resurrection. It has to occur. And then it was foretold by Yeshua himself. For example, in all the Gospels, Matthew 20:19, Yeshua is speaking. "They will hand him over to the Gentiles to mock and scourge and crucify him. And on the third day, he will be raised up." He's not afraid of being permanently under the clutches of sin and death. And then in Mark 9:9, And as they were coming down from the mountain, he gave them orders not to relate to anyone what they had seen until the Son of Man, what? Rose from the dead. That's followed up in Mark 14:28. But after I have been raised from the dead, I will go ahead of you to Galilee. And finally, the fourth gospel then, Matthew, Mark, and here's John. Jesus answered them, "Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up." And the Jews then said, "Look, it took 46 years to build this temple, and will you raise it up in 3 days? But he was speaking of the temple of his body. So when he was raised from the dead, his disciples remembered that he said this, and they believed the scripture and the word which Yeshua had spoken." So Yeshua knew that he would experience resurrection. So suggestion number three here is really a bit far-fetched. So what is the cup? What is the cup? Well, suggestion number four is the best suggestion that fits the case. The cup represents the coming wrath of God. Yeshua is anticipating the onslaught of the wrath of God. That's not a pretty thing to look forward to. On the cross, he will say, my God, why have you forsaken me? At that point, the sins of the world were placed upon the Son of God. At that moment, the Father and the Son experienced a judicial relationship, something that had never happened before in eternity past. God the Father never had to judge God the Son. So it's hard for us to appreciate the meaning of this in relation to Yeshua. Why? Because we're born spiritually dead. We don't know anything different. We're all born under the wrath, the judgment of God. All of us are born separated from God. Now go to the top of page 25 in your outline. You know, we all start out under the judicial relationship with God. We know nothing else. For example, all believers are objects of God's wrath, Ephesians 2:3. Among them, that's the world, we too all formerly lived in the lusts of our flesh, indulging the desires of the flesh and of the mind, and were by nature children of wrath, even as the rest. Every unbeliever lives and is born and lives under God's wrath. But then we receive salvation from God's wrath through Yeshua's substitutionary sacrifice for us and through his second coming, Romans 5:6. Much more than having been justified by his blood, his sacrifice, we shall be saved from the wrath of God through him. You see, he's our Savior from the wrath of God. 1 Thessalonians 1:10. And wait for his Son from heaven, whom he raised from the dead. That is Yeshua, who what? He rescues us from the wrath to come. Okay, that's our situation. But here, we have a person. Here we have a being who from eternity past was in continuous, positive, wonderful relationship with his Father. There was perfect harmony, a perfect family relationship. At no point in eternity past was obedience or disobedience ever an issue between God the Son and God the Father. They were in absolute agreement, absolute unity in everything. In everything. But then the Son entered into space and time at the incarnation. And now the Son of God is fully God and fully man. He's put himself in the position where he can experience the wrath of God. And that moment is coming. It's bearing down on him like a runaway freight train. So Yeshua prays that the cup of wrath to fall on him will only fall if it is the Father's will. And, of course, it is the Father's will for him to drink the cup of wrath to the full, every drop of it. Yeshua's desire was one thing, but he's living out his role of a servant. Philippians 2, 5-11, remember? A servant does the will of the master. And so God's will is greater. So he submits to the will of the Father. Not my will, but your will be done. This is the ultimate expression of humble servitude. Humble servanthood. Isn't that amazing? Let me repeat that. This is the ultimate expression of humble servanthood. Now, in the Garden of Eden, Adam experienced disobedience. In the Garden of Gethsemane, the last Adam experienced obedience. And so at this point, we come to Matthew 26:46. Get up, let us be going. Behold, the one who betrays me is at hand. And so the agony in the garden is concluded. All right, now we're in section 227, lesson 13, page 26 at the top of the page. And of course, let's remember we are in the Garden of Gethsemane at this time. And here is our photograph of the Garden of Gethsemane right there. All right. We'll see in section 227 that Jesus is betrayed, arrested, and forsaken. Now, the main complaint the Pharisees have against Yeshua is the violation of their traditional laws, the Mishnah, the traditions of the fathers. They were never able to accuse Yeshua of violating any commandment of the Mosaic law. He's the only Jew who ever lived out the Mosaic law perfectly. Now, in their attempts to do away with him, they themselves will violate the very Mishnah they've been accusing Yeshua of violating. In the course of the religious trials of Yeshua, the arrest, the civil trial, they will violate a total of 21 traditional laws, 21 of their own Mishnaic laws. You see, part of the Mishnah contains the laws of the Sanhedrin regarding trials, and trials that have to do with a capital offense. And Yeshua is being tried for a capital offense, the death penalty. So 21 laws were violated, and these laws are provided for you in your outline, and we'll cover them as they are violated in sequence. Before we get into those individual laws, let's look at the Sanhedrin legal tradition. Now, why? Why did the Sanhedrin feel free to set aside the very traditions they held so dear? Wouldn't there be a clamor within their own ranks? Wouldn't there be a sense of distaste for such a hypocritical act? The answer is no. The answer is no. The setting aside of Sanhedrin legal tradition had a precedent. Now, the information that I'm going to share with you came from the Art Scroll Mishnah series, Masorah Publications. That's an excellent series to buy if you'd like commentaries on the Mishnah, if you're studying the Mishnah. So from the Art Scroll Mishnah series, we read about the legal precedent. Rabbi Eliezer cites the precedent of Shimon ben Shattach, the head of the Sanhedrin in his time, about 100 years earlier, who in a single day had 80 women executed by stoning for practicing witchcraft. Now, by law, this is traditional Mishnaic law, by law, a court may not perform more than one execution in a single day, so that they devote ample time to investigate thoroughly the possibility of innocence. Thus, Shimon ben Shetach's act was obviously an exception. So we see an exception to the rule here. Then we go to Talmud, Ma'aseh Yevamot 90b. And let's read about the data we find in Yevamot 90b. Come and hear, Rabbi Eliezer ben Jacob stated, I heard that even without any Pentateuchal authority over their rulings, Beit Din, court of law, may administer flogging and the death penalty. Not, however, for the purpose of transgressing the words of the Torah, but in order to make a fence around the Torah. See, the fence around the Torah is the Mishnah. And so they're afraid of the fence being broken. They're afraid of the Mishnah being broken. They don't want anybody to get through this fence and get to the Mosaic law. So they're trying to repair their fence here. But in order to make a fence for the Torah, make sure that fence is solid and secure. It once happened that a man rode on horseback on the Sabbath in the days of the Greeks. And he was brought before Beit Din and was stoned, not because he deserved the penalty, but because the exigencies, the urgent circumstances of the hour, demanded it. And another incident occurred with a man, and he was brought before Beit Din and flogged. Again, not because he deserved such a penalty, but because the urgent circumstances, the exigencies of the hour, demanded it. To safeguard a cause is different. All right. What have we learned? What have we learned? We've learned about a principle. We've learned about a principle derived from Yevamot 90b. Now, the source of the information I give you is, again, the Art Scroll Mishnah Commentary on Tractate Sanhedrin. Here we read the legal precedent, Yevamot 90b. The Sanhedrin is allowed to act in extra legal ways on a temporary basis if there is a compelling reason to do so. There it is. The Sanhedrin is allowed to act on an extra legal basis, on an extra legal ways, on a temporary basis, if there is a compelling reason to do so. Now, this precedent had been in place since Simon ben Shetach for about 100 years. For about 100 years, this precedent had floated there in the Mishnah. Now, Yeshua was a dangerous enough individual in the Sanhedrin's eyes that they felt they had justification enough to act in an extra legal way in this case. John 11:48. If we let him go on like this, all men will believe in him, and the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation. This is the urgent circumstances as the Sanhedrin viewed them. So this, I submit to you, that this was the compelling reason, the rationale, to violate 21 of their own Mishnaic laws. I think this is the reason behind it all. All right, the Jewish date is the 15th of Nisan, the wee hours of Friday morning, Nisan 15, AD 30. We pick it up in John 18:2. Now Judas also, who was betraying him, knew the place, Gethsemane, for Yeshua had met there, had often met there with his disciples. Now remember, Judas is needed for three reasons. The first reason, to show where Yeshua can be taken apart from the multitudes. Not for identification. Oh, he's been teaching publicly in the temple. They know who he is. Primarily, this is for secrecy. They don't want opposition. They don't want trouble. They want this to just to be done, you know, under the rug. So now Judas is able to fulfill the first of the three reasons that he was hired. The second reason, before the Roman governor could release his cohort, his soldiers, an accusation had to be brought so Rome could indict Yeshua. So Judas would come before Pontius Pilate with an accusation, then Pilate would release his soldiers for the arrest. All right, verse 3. Judas then, having received the Roman cohort, and officers from the chief priests and the Pharisees, came there with lanterns and torches and weapons. Now a Roman cohort equals 400 to 600 men. So this fulfilled the second function for which Judas had been hired. Remember, Roman law said that before they could release the cohort for the arrest, one had to bring a formal indictment, a formal charge. Now, here's Judas' betrayal. This is the sequence of events for Judas's betrayal. Apparently, after Judas left the Passover, he then went to the chief priests and the elders and told them his hand had been forced. You know, Jesus knows all about what's going on here. We got to do it now. He then went to Pilate, or was sent to Pilate, and produced a charge before Pilate for which Yeshua could be tried under Roman law. Probably, and I'm surmising here, probably Judas says, he says he's the king of the Jews. You know, that's the thing that Pilate was worried about when he interviews Jesus. You're the king of the Jews? And that would, in other words, Yeshua is an insurrectionist. He wants to overthrow Caesar. He wants to overthrow Rome. He's the king of the Jews. So I think that's the charge that Judas probably brought to Pilate. Now, this is why, we'll see later, that although it's the wee hours of the morning, Pilate is dressed and ready to conduct a trial as soon as they bring Jesus in. Well, why? Because Judas had already appeared earlier in the wee hours of the morning. He got Pilate out of bed and brought this accusation to him. So, fourthly, Pilate then released the cohort. He brought the official charge, and so at this point, Pilate releases the soldiers. The cohort is released. Now, Judas probably leads them, first of all, to John Mark's home where the Passover was held. That's the last place he saw Yeshua. That's the place he probably expected to catch him and the disciples, you know, trapped in the upper room. But they're gone. Yeshua said, we need to get out of here. We need to finish up the Seder and move on. So finding Yeshua gone, he then leads them to Gethsemane. Now, let's take a look. Let's recall the third function for the need of Judas. This is the top of page 30. The third reason, Judas is needed as a prosecuting witness at the civil trial. He's not needed for the religious trial. He's needed for the civil trial to testify to a charge so Rome could execute Yeshua. So he'll be needed as a prosecuting witness to witness that Jesus is trying to be king. He's an insurrectionist. He wants to overthrow Caesar, you know, something like that. But for reasons we'll see later, he will fail to be there. All right, let's get down to these legal violations that we're talking about. Let's start with verse 2 again, verse 2 of John 18. Now Judas also, who was betraying him, knew the place, for Jesus had often met there with the disciples. Now this is the first violation of Sanhedrin law. This is number 1 on your list. There was to be no arrest by religious authorities that was affected by a bribe. Exodus 23:8. You shall not take a bribe, for a bribe blinds the clear-sighted and subverts the cause of the just. And this arrest has been effected by a bribe, 30 pieces of silver. Judas is betraying Jesus. Remember that? How much will you pay me for me to betray him? So they hired him with 30 pieces of silver. Verse 3. Judas then, having received the Roman cohort and officers from the chief priests and the Pharisees, came there with lanterns and torches and weapons. This is the second violation of Sanhedrin law, Mishnaic law. Number 2 on the list. There was to be no steps of criminal proceedings after sunset. And yet they need lanterns and torches. They're there in the middle of the night, in the morning, you know, in the deep blackness of the early morning. So they are arresting him after sunset, at night. Now, who were the people present at the arrest? Altogether, there were 4 groups of people present at the arrest. Here's the arresting group. A, number 1, Roman soldiers, a minimum of 400. 2, servants of the high priest. 3, other Jewish officers. And 4, Sanhedrin members. Let's look at verse 52 of Luke 22. Then Yeshua said to the chief priests and the officers of the temple and elders who had come against him, "Have you come out with swords and clubs as you would against a robber?" Now this is Luke 22:52 is on page 225 of your Harmony. This is the Harmony if you've purchased it. This is the middle of the right-hand column, page 225 of your Harmony. So the presence of the chief priests and the elders constitutes a third violation of Mishnaic law, number 3 on the list. Judges or Sanhedrin members are not allowed to participate in the arrest. Now let's take a look at the Matthew account, Matthew 26:55. Again, this is in the Harmony on page 225, the left-hand column. At that time, Yeshua said to the crowds, "Have you come out with swords and clubs to arrest me as you would against a robber? Every day I used to sit in the temple teaching and you did not seize me." So a multitude came. A crowd was there. There were over 400 people at this arrest. Maybe even over 600. Who knows? If the cohort was 600, it could have been well over 600 people. And they come with swords and clubs. Now, the Greek word for sword means a short military sword used in combat. So they were ready to do battle, if necessary, to arrest Yeshua. They assumed his followers would fight to save him. If he's an insurrectionist, that would be a very logical conclusion. All right, let's go back to John 18, 4 and 5. This is page 223 of your harmony. Jump back in your harmony. We come to the Messiah's response. This is the top of page 31 in your outline. Page 31 in your outline. As the cohort approaches, Yeshua takes control. John 18, verses 4 and 5. So Yeshua, knowing that all things were coming upon him, went forth to them and said to them, "Whom do you seek?" And they answered him, "Yeshua the Nazarene." And he said to them, "I am." And Judas also, who was betraying him, was standing with them. Notice, "I am he" is in the text. And the "he" is in italics. That's because the word "he" is not in the original Greek text. It is supplied by the translators. It's a translator's decision. I would cross it out so that the text reads, "I am." That's what the actual text reads. The word "I am" means more than simply identifying himself. The words "I am" in this case are a claim to deity. John points this out in verse 6. Power accompanied the words "I am." He's not merely saying, "I am Yeshua." He's saying, "I am Yahweh." "I am" is the name of God. "I am the Lord. I am Yahweh." Verse 6. "So when he said to them, 'I am,' they drew back and fell to the ground." To show who's in control here, with a word, he forces the entire party of 400 plus men down to the ground, including Judas. And the point is to let them know that if he's being arrested, he allows himself to be arrested. He is in control. Verses 7 through 9. "Therefore he again asked them, 'Whom do you seek?' And they said, 'Jesus the Nazarene.' And Jesus answered, 'I told you that I am. So if you seek me, let these go their way.'" So a second time the question is asked, "Whom do you seek?" And for a second time he answers, "I am." But he does not exercise his divine power at the second expression of "I am." So he clearly identified himself to the Roman cohort. So there's no need for Judas to fulfill the thing he'd promised to do. But Judas is going to earn his money anyway. And he's going to earn it in spite of the fact that Yeshua has identified himself twice. So now we come to the kiss. This is Mark 14:44. In your harmony of the Gospels, this is page 224 in the harmony. Mark 14:44. "Excuse me." I should have added there John 18:7-9. Let me back up one. "If you seek me, let these go their way, to fulfill the word which he had spoke. Of those whom you have given me, I lost no one." Okay. So we now come to the kiss of Judas in Mark 14:44. "Now he who was betraying him had given them a signal, saying, 'Whomever I kiss, he is the one. Seize him and lead him away under guard.'" It's as if Yeshua is going out of his way to give Judas every opportunity not to betray him. The kiss was the sign to identify which man in the garden was Yeshua. However, there's no need to do this now. Yeshua has identified himself. But Judas fulfills the promise anyway. He begins to draw near to Yeshua, and at that point Yeshua gives him a warning, verse 48. But Jesus said to him, "Judas, are you betraying the Son of Man with a kiss?" And this doesn't stop Judas either. Go to Mark 14:45, and this is on page 32 of your outline. Mark 14:45, "After coming, Judas immediately went to him, saying, 'Rabbi,' and kissed him." Now, the Greek word here is an intensive form. It indicates that he kissed him many times, more than once. Judas is profaning the sacred. The kissing of a rabbi in Jewish circles was a sign of discipleship, and he uses the term a rabbi, and he kisses him. Normally, the fellow is submitting as a disciple of a rabbi. Then in Psalm 2:12, the kiss is also a sign of homage. Psalm 2:12. Do homage, literally, kiss the Son, that he not become angry and you perish in the way, for his wrath may soon be kindled. How blessed are all those who take refuge in him. Psalm 2:12. Kiss the Son. That which is sacred in the Jewish world, that which is sacred in the Bible, is being profaned by Judas. Well, Peter's response, middle of page 32. At this point, Peter does prove something. At the Passover, Peter said he was willing to die. We come to verse 10. John 18:10. Simon Peter then, having a sword, drew it and struck the high priest's slave and cut off his right ear. And the slave's name was Malchus. So he struck the high priest's slave and cut off his right ear. Now, the Roman sword was a short military combat sword. And the very same word is used in Peter's case here. But it's a word that has a range of meaning. Now, the Greek word for sword in the case of Peter here would indicate a long ceremonial knife that had been used for the sacrifice of the Passover lamb. That's why Peter had it. He and John had to go and sacrifice the lamb. So here Peter starts swinging away with this Passover knife, and there are 400 soldiers there with military combat swords. So he proves he's willing to die for the Messiah. And he aims at the head, and he misses, and he cuts off the ear. He doesn't even cut off the ear of a soldier. He cuts off the ear of the servant of the high priest. Peter's a fisherman. He's not a soldier. He's not a swordsman. He's a fisherman. Now, John is the only one who records the name of the servant, Malchus, because the family of John and the family of Caiaphas were friends. The family of the high priest there and John's family were friends. We'll learn this in section 228. So at this point, Yeshua stops Peter. We come to the Messiah's rebuke, which is atop of page 33 in your outline, Matthew 26:52. Then Yeshua said to him, "Put your sword back in its place, for all those who take up the sword will perish by the sword." So Yeshua rebukes Peter with three statements. First of all those who wish to live this way will die this way. Peter, this is the wrong way to react. The faith cannot be defended with the sword, because you reap what you sow. Verse 53. "Or do you think that I cannot appeal to my Father, and he will at once put at my disposal more than 12 legions of angels?" Peter, you're using the wrong message. You're using the wrong method. That's the word I want. Peter, you're using the wrong method. You need to pray about this, because a spiritual battle must be won by spiritual means. It must be fought with spiritual means. Peter, pray. Don't attack. Verse 54. "How then will the scriptures be fulfilled, which say that it must happen in this way?" Peter, this is necessary for the scriptures to be fulfilled. You're compromising the scriptures, Peter. And so Luke brings out the next aspect of Yeshua's response in Luke 22:51. "But Yeshua answered and said, 'Stop, no more of this.' And he touched his ear and healed him." Now, Luke is the only one who tells us of Yeshua's healing the ear. Luke is the doctor, you know. This fact fascinates him. This action of healing Malchus's ear saves Peter's life. There's no way he could have taken on 400 soldiers. So this healing is the only miracle we know of that Yeshua performs on a fresh wound, a bleeding wound. And this is the only miracle we know of that Yeshua performs on an obvious active enemy. Now, all of this emphasizes Yeshua's own victory in the agony of Gethsemane and his determination to do the will of the Father. You know, Yeshua had taught to do good to your enemies, Luke 6:27. But I say to you who hear, love your enemies, do good to those who hate you. So he's lived out his own teaching. He's just done good to his enemies. He's healed Malchus on the spot. Matthew 26:56. But all this has taken place to fulfill the scriptures of the prophets. Then all the disciples left him and fled. So this is a fulfillment of scripture contained in the prophets. This is a summary statement of all that the first coming prophecies taught. Now, he made a promise in the upper room, and it's fulfilled here. The disciples leave him and flee. They leave him to his fate. They're too afraid. He knew they would. All right, let's pause for a little biographical insight. This is the bottom of page 33 on your outline. Now, when people wrote a biography in the ancient world, or they wrote stories, they often included themselves in a very passing, kind of irrelevant way. And this is the example in Mark verses 51 and 52. What Mark says here doesn't connect or precede with what follows. Verses 51 and 52, Mark 14. A young man was following him, wearing nothing but a linen sheet over his naked body. And they seized him, but he pulled free of the linen sheet and escaped naked. So Mark is writing his gospel in the style of the ancient world. He was an eyewitness to the arrest. He's the one who took off naked. Now, why was he there in the first place? Well, apparently, Judas led the cohort to John Mark's house first. And they found that Jesus and the disciples were gone. Of course, Mark had been awakened. Apparently, Passover was over for his family as well, and he was sleeping. So Mark then followed, dressed only in his sleeping attire. Okay, at this point we come to section 228. Now, sections 228 to 232 cover the three stages of the religious trial. And the issue here will be blasphemy. Now, Judas is not needed at this stage. He will be needed for the civil trial later. But Jewish law did not require his presence at a religious trial. All right, I see I have about 3 minutes left, and I think I've got a bit more than 3 minutes worth of material in section 228. So we're now at lesson 13. This is page 34 in your outline. Section 228, the first Jewish trial, the first Jewish phase, and this is before Annas. This is before Annas. Let's see, where I am. That's the button I want to push. There we go. So we'll call it quits right here. We'll call it quits right here. And we'll pick up this first Jewish trial next session. So thanks so much for being our students. I trust that this study in the Jewish life of the Messiah is blessing your heart and drawing you closer to Yeshua and encouraging you to be more and more of a committed disciple, to walk more and more in the light of the Messiah each day. Thanks so much for being our students. Lehitraot. Lehitraot.